It seems like every movie about tyranny has the same costume designer. Jack boots, blood red flags, men yelling in unison like a militant flash mob. It's all very dramatic, very cinematic. You know, very soul last century. That's the image tattooed in our collective unconscious in any case. So we sit here thinking, well, as long as nobody's goose-stepping past my artisanal coffee shop, we're fine. Meanwhile, the real thing is happening in athleisure wear made by invisible workers and AI-curated outrage. Now, authoritarianism, it didn't just crash through the door like some drunk relative at Thanksgiving. It showed up like a free trial you forgot to cancel. You know, the kind that auto-renews in the middle of the night while you're deep in some Netflix coma. So it's quiet and polite, and it's automatic. And of course you keep meaning to unsubscribe, but you're too busy optimizing your LinkedIn networking strategy and arguing with bots whether the Great Resignation was empowerment or just everyone finally admitting their jobs were meaningless. And the charges pile up in your Democratic bank account. And then one day, you wake up and the balance isn't constitutional republic anymore. It's some kind of cursed hybrid of reality show, mafia protection racket, and a middle school popularity contest run by the kids who peaked in high school. And you're still paying the monthly fee. And the scary part of this is that it doesn't need your loyalty. Loyalty is so needy. It doesn't even need your fear, because fear requires too much emotional labor. All it needs is you exhausted and scrolling, thumb deep in the digital dopamine drip. That's what I call the triple D. Now, the new model of control doesn't herd you into stadiums to chant slogans. It just keeps you on your ergonomic couch, drowning in push notifications about celebrities' breakfast choices while democracy quietly decomposes in the corner like that forgotten takeout. And institutions are now rotting like that bag of spinach you bought with good intentions, but you're too distracted by TikTok dances or whatever to throw them out. And corruption isn't shocking anymore. It's just Tuesday's trending flavor, somewhere between politician takes bribes and influencer sells snake oil to teenagers. And that's the brilliance of it. This new authoritarianism doesn't arrest you for what you say, not yet, at least. It just buries you in so much algorithmic white noise that you forget you had anything to say at all. I mean, if you can't tell what's true, and the system makes sure you can't, then you just stop fighting for anything meaningful. And then you start muttering, "Now they're all corrupt anyway," while the constitutional ground quietly shifts under your feet. And this is how freedom ends now. It's not with jackbooted thugs, but with an infinite scroll that never quite reaches the bottom. Okay, So you don't wake up one day to find tanks rolling down Main Street. Instead, you wake up to find your rights reduced to an app notification that cheerfully chirps terms of service updated. And it's in that same tone your phone uses to remind you about your cousin's birthday. And you scroll right past it like every other piece of digital debris cluttering your notification center. That's the new playbook. There's no parades. There's no grand manifestos printed on parchment. Just a slow IV drip of freedoms quietly expiring while you're too busy deciding between 15 types of toilet paper. So, contemporary authoritarianism is bite-sized. It's snackable tyranny for the TikTok generation. You don't get the dramatic spectacle your history book, your history textbooks promised. There's no Nuremberg rallies, no midnight knocks on doors, etc. You get the subscription model. A monthly automatic deduction of civil liberties you barely notice until your Democratic account hits zero and you're wondering why nothing works anymore. And the institutions don't collapse in some cinematic explosion, though that would be a lot more exciting. They get quietly Airbnb'd out to the highest bidder. Courts still exist. Elections still happen in some form. Regulatory agencies still have impressive logos and motivational posters about serving the public. They just don't belong to you anymore. They're like vacation rentals that still have the original family's photos on the walls and their coffee mugs in the cupboard, but somebody else is living there using your constitutional toothbrush and leaving passive-aggressive notes about the thermostat. And if you complain, they just direct you to check the frequently asked questions section of a website that hasn't updated since 2017. And I think we'd all agree at this point that corruption isn't even a scandal anymore. Scandals require public attention spans longer than a goldfish having an anxiety attack. It's all been normalized. And it's just a business model or a lifestyle brand. It's a whole aesthetic now. Everyone's taking their cut while delivering TED Talks about shared sacrifice and difficult but necessary transitions. And the people pulling the strings, they don't ask for your devotion because devotion is high maintenance and, requires actual charisma. They ask for your boredom because a bored citizen is a manageable citizen, a citizen who will accept literally anything as long as it comes with free shipping and doesn't interrupt their true crime podcast. As for the propaganda machine, forget those charmingly retro Big Brother posters. This isn't one message that's hammered into your skull 1,000 times. It's more like 1,000 messages hammered into your... it's more like 1,000 contradictory messages delivered once each. like a hydra made of hot takes and conspiracy theories. It's more like a calculated flood of digital sewage designed to make you throw up your hands and mumble, who even knows what's real anymore? And once you stop believing in the possibility of truth itself, they've won without even firing a shot. They don't have to mobilize you for some glorious cause. They just have to keep scrolling past democracy's death certificate while you're shopping for succulents and arguing about whether Die Hard is a Christmas movie. And meanwhile, society continues to polarize like a messy divorce where both parties hire the same lawyer. Real Americans versus coastal elites, patriots versus globalist shills. You know, it's all performance art. But the script works beautifully. And the fighting keeps you distracted while the same oligarchic hands systematically pick your pockets with the efficiency of a Las Vegas casino. Left, right, center, whatever. They all look like different streaming services, but it's the same content farm serving you the same manufactured outrage with different branding. And here's the insidious part. It makes you think you're being wise by just opting out entirely. You retreat into your curated little private bubble, convinced you're staying sane while everyone else loses their minds. But that isolation isn't necessarily wisdom. It's a gift wrapped present to authoritarians. And I get it. You know, I want to opt out entirely. But I struggle with this. I struggle with this being the answer. You know, the thing is you know, when you're alone with your houseplants and your artisanal tea collection or whatever, you're not a citizen. You're just another data point in someone else's algorithm, another consumer who stopped asking, you know, those inconvenient questions. All right. So we like to imagine freedom as this massive marble statue. Eternal, immovable, carved by the founding fathers with abs that would make Chris Hemsworth weep. But it's not. Freedom is more like a houseplant. It's a fickle, temperamental houseplant that requires daily attention and the right amount of intellectual sunlight. You stop watering it with civic engagement for a few months, and suddenly it's drooping sadly in the corner while you're Googling how to tell if democracy is dead. And democracy isn't protected by monuments or constitutional parchment under glass. It's actually protected by habits. Those, small, unglamorous civic reflexes that keep a society's pulse steady. For instance, reading opposing viewpoints without immediately drafting a manifesto about why the other side are historically illiterate monsters, as tempting as that may be. Showing up at a school board meeting and staying awake. Signing your actual name to something something you actually believe rather than hiding behind an avatar that's half anime character and half political slogan. having a civil conversation with the person at the bus stop whose political opinions make you want to gnaw through your own wrist. That's democracy's equivalent of flossing your teeth. It's boring, slightly uncomfortable, but if you skip it long enough, the rot sets in deeper than you thought possible. Now, modern authoritarianism, it doesn't need to ban those civic reflexes. Market forces do the heavy lifting. The system simply makes them feel obsolete or quaint, like insisting on handwritten letters in the age of emoji. So instead, it replaces them with the intellectual equivalent of fast food. You know, doom scrolling, rage bait headlines, hot takes designed to make you feel informed while leaving you cognitively malnourished. So imagine CrossFit for cynicism. You walk out feeling sore and accomplished, but you haven't actually built anything sustainable. Just some temporary muscle for being outraged at people you'll never meet about problems you can't even solve. Now, this is where thinkers like Hannah Arendt deserve credit for seeing around corners decades ahead of the rest of us. Now, she observed that evil doesn't need jackboots and dramatic lighting, or in music for that matter. It just needs a critical mass of people who stop thinking critically, who become what she called simply thoughtless. And Eric Fromm diagnosed the same psychological vulnerability. Freedom feels terrifying when you're drowning in choices. So we secretly crave someone else to lift the burden of decision-making from our exhausted shoulders. And we hand over the steering wheel while telling ourselves we're just taking a quick nap. Even George Carlin, who could perform surgery on sacred cows using only sarcasm and perfect timing, he understood this paradox. He said he didn't hate people. He hated groups, crowds. The moment individual consciousness dissolves into tribal static. But he believed in the individual. Now, he said you can see the whole universe in a person's eyes. Now, real belonging, it doesn't require marching in formation. Sometimes it's just sharing a moment of honest recognition with another human being who's still actually mentally present. And that's the democratic paradox. The same system designed to distract and isolate you also whispers that the only rational response is complete withdrawal from civic life. But withdrawal isn't really wisdom. It's another form of control, just more comfortable and self-imposed. As difficult as it is to admit, that it's not the answer, unfortunately. So actual resistance, it begins in the small, boring acts of connection that can't be monetized or turned into content. Conversations, reading books that challenge your assumptions, showing up for people and causes without posting about it. The non-virtue signaling version. It's the unglamorous maintenance work that keeps civic muscles from atrophying into decorative vestigial organs. Okay. In my humble estimation, the most unsettling aspect of contemporary authoritarianism isn't the laws or the militarized police cosplaying as action heroes. It's the psychological real estate it quietly purchases inside your skull, where it sets up shop rent-free in the space between your ears. It doesn't live in your conscious thoughts. That would be too obvious and too easy to evict. So instead, it takes up residence in your scrolling thumb, in that low-grade anxiety that you're perpetually behind on news you didn't actually want to consume anyway. And it shows up in the vague dread that everyone else knows something you don't. It's like living with chronic inflammation of the soul, like a persistent psychic smog that leaves you tired and irritable without any obvious source that you can name or treat. And people imagine that they can escape this mental colonization by just logging off, as if authoritarianism were just a browser tab you can close. But you can't uninstall a mood, and you can't delete the cognitive habits that digital manipulation has trained into your neural pathways at this point. I mean, even offline, you catch yourself thinking in algorithmic patterns. Who's with me? Who's against me? What's trending in my own mental feed? Which thoughts will get the most internal likes, etc., etc.? It's like having an invisible autocrat whispering editorial suggestions in your ear, never quite giving orders, but somehow always influencing the conversation you're having with yourself. So psychologists have been studying this phenomenon since the 1970s, calling it learned helplessness. First, this was observed in laboratory dogs who eventually stopped trying to escape electric shocks, even when escape became possible. Now it's the emotional soundtrack of entire democracies. You try voting, nothing changes. You try protesting, nothing changes. You try engaging with institutions and they respond with form letters written by AI and signed by nobody. And eventually, the helplessness stops feeling like a temporary condition and starts feeling like a personality trait, a mature acceptance of how things really work, that psychological surrender is a real coup. It's more effective than any military takeover. I mean, this is where we are at now. So ultimately, the system pulls off a particularly perverse trick. It teaches you to worship community while systematically making actual community unbearable. Scroll through any platform long enough, and every group looks like either a cult or a firing squad. Every conversation becomes a performance for an invisible audience of potential critics. Every human becomes a caricature of their worst political opinions. Now, under these conditions, I can see why it's infinitely easier to just stay home with your streaming services and your carefully curated solitude, convinced that you're preserving your sanity, while everyone else loses theirs in the digital coliseum. But I think there's a crucial difference between chosen solitude and enforced isolation. Real solitude, you know, like the kind we hear about from Thoreau when he practiced at Walden, or that Alan Watts wrote about in his Explorations of Eastern Philosophy, is active engagement with your own consciousness without external interference. It's the difference between choosing to be alone and being shipwrecked on an island of your own making. Now, one nourishes creativity and clarity, and the other slowly atrophies your capacity for connection and empathy. And even the most dedicated introverts, the people who can read social dynamics like CIA profilers, but would rather spend Saturday night reorganizing their book collection, still require human connection to maintain psychological health. Okay, so Carl Jung understood this when he wrote about individuation. Not as cutting yourself off from humanity, but as becoming strong enough to stand as an individual while remaining in meaningful relationships with others. Now, Carl Rogers called it unconditional positive regard, the rare experience of being truly seen by another person without their psychological filters distorting you into a projection of their fears or fantasies. And this is why I think Carlin's observation about seeing the universe in someone's eyes remains politically radical. Because real belonging doesn't require mass movements or ideological purity tests. Sometimes it's just one honest friend, one conversation that doesn't sound like a press release, or one text message that acknowledges your humanity instead of trying to recruit you for something. And in a culture engineered to atomize and commodify human connection, those moments of genuine recognition become quiet acts of resistance against systems that profit from your loneliness. All right. If you imagine today's slow motion democratic strangulation is historically unprecedented, well, you're half right. The delivery message or method has evolved. The slogans are focus grouped. The technology is smarter. The oppression comes with better user interfaces. But I think the underlying psychological dynamics are a little dysfunctional. Because humans have been enthusiastically trading freedom for the illusion of security since we figured out how to organize ourselves into groups larger than hunting parties. So the philosophers and the historians who studied these patterns, they weren't just academic observers, they were early warning systems that we largely ignored. Now, Eric Fromm diagnosed this in his book, Escape from Freedom, which he wrote while watching Europeans voluntarily surrender their democracies to fascism. Now, his insight here cuts like a blade. True freedom terrifies people, but not because it's inherently dangerous. It's terrifying because it demands we take responsibility for our choices, our lives. And understandably, that responsibility feels overwhelming when you're already exhausted by the basic demands of existence, you know, paying rent, keeping or finding a job, maintaining relationships, pretending to understand cryptocurrency and climate science simultaneously, and so on and so on. So we outsource our agency to these charismatic leaders and to institutions we've never really examined, to algorithms that promise to curate reality for us while we focus on more manageable problems like trying to get enough sleep or whatever. Even now, decades later, Fromm's analysis still operates like a psychological X-ray of sorts. The easier it becomes to hand your decision-making power to someone or something else, the more likely you are to do it. Even if that something is a combination of AI-driven news feeds designed to maximize engagement through outrage and social media platforms that turn every human interaction into content for an audience of strangers. It's not really traditional totalitarianism. It's total convenience. If convenience came with the side effect of gradual existential decay and the slow erosion of your capacity for independent thought. All right. Historian and philosopher Hannah Arendt provided another piece of the puzzle with her analysis of what she called the banality of evil. Now, she sat in a courtroom watching Adolf Eichmann, not in the form of some foaming at the mouth monster that you might expect, but just a bureaucrat in a suit, politely following procedures that enabled unimaginable horror through administrative efficiency. Now, her lesson seems to be resonating in our current era of algorithmic governance. Evil doesn't always announce itself with dramatic flourishes. More likely, at this point, it's arriving through institutional processes, policy updates, terms of service agreements, and systems that are so complex that no single person feels responsible for their collective impact. And today's equivalent might be your social media feed, where misinformation spreads a lot faster than empathy, where you find yourself nodding along to ideas you'd never tolerate in face-to-face conversation, and where moral inertia becomes a weapon of social control. Now, the platform isn't trying to undermine democracy. It's just trying to maximize user engagement and advertising revenue. It's always about money, ultimately. But the cumulative effect of millions of people having their attention harvested and their emotions manipulated for profit, that's its own form of quiet totalitarianism, delivered with notification sounds and gamified dopamine hits. So Timothy Snyder updates these insights for our current moment in his book On Tyranny, which documents how democracies don't usually collapse in dramatic coups, but through incremental erosion. And that's what we're going through. You know, a little corruption normalized here, a little intimidation accepted there. And the next thing you know, institutions continue to exist, but serve powerful interests more reliably than the public ones. Courts still operate, elections still happen, media organizations still publish, but they become increasingly theatrical, which we have seen, and convincing enough to maintain the appearance of democratic legitimacy while power consolidates in fewer and fewer hands, which we have seen. Now, if this description sounds familiar, well, it should. I mean, this process is, it's subtle, it's insidious, and it's terrifyingly effective precisely because it doesn't feel like oppression while it's happening. Shoshana Zuboff adds the technological dimension with the age of surveillance capitalism, showing how digital platforms have created new forms of social control that make traditional propaganda look quaint. The state doesn't need to shout orders when algorithms can just whisper suggestions directly into your subconscious. Your preferences, your fears, all analyzed and weaponized to influence your behavior in ways you don't consciously recognize. So you scroll, you click, you share memes that confirm your worldview, while invisible systems nudge you towards compliance and endless consumption and political passivity. So welcome to algorithmic authoritarianism. It's quieter than jackboots, but somehow more invasive than traditional surveillance states ever managed to be. Now, these thinkers converge on a single uncomfortable truth. Authoritarianism doesn't have to be obvious to be lethal. In fact, the more comfortable, entertaining, and familiar that it feels, the more dangerous it becomes. And the most effective oppression convinces you that you're free while systematically narrowing your range of possible thoughts and actions. But I think the most terrifying realization is this isn't just about them, the politicians, the plutocrats, and you know, nefarious shadowy forces manipulating society from behind the scenes. It's about us and what we've allowed ourselves to accept as normal without questioning the cost of our comfort. I mean, we're being just hypnotized right into this disaster. So now you have, okay, so now you have the diagnosis, the slow motion democratic suffocation, algorithms performing behavioral modification surgery on your brain without anesthesia, institutions hollowed out like jack-o'-lanterns carved by drunk teenagers, and your civic muscles atrophying from digital malnutrition. Isn't that nice? So the question becomes, what do you actually do with this, all this information? Sit quietly and hope some entrepreneur invents a freedom app that solves democracy through blockchain technology? Probably not. Though there may be somebody, you know, working on that right now. There are, I think, some genuine responses available without pretending you're suddenly Mahatma Gandhi or turning your entire life into a performatively woke Instagram feed. First, cultivate critical thinking like it's a survival skill, which it absolutely is in an age of weaponized information. Or I should say, you know, weaponized misinformation. Question the headlines that make you feel smugly superior to people you disagree with. And recognize when the outrage you're experiencing is being manufactured for someone else's political or financial benefit. Try to read widely, especially sources that challenge your existing beliefs and make you slightly uncomfortable. Think rigorously about your own assumptions. Argue quietly with yourself until you can articulate why you believe what you believe beyond it just feels right or everyone smart agrees with me. Watch for patterns in how information flows through your social networks. When you catch yourself nodding along to something just because it requires no mental effort, stop. That's exactly the moment when democratic consciousness dies and algorithmic programming takes over. Second, engage in small-scale civic participation that doesn't require you to become a professional activist or martyr for any particular cause. You know, not marches with millions of people chanting slogans that will be forgotten by next week's news cycle, not Twitter wars with anonymous accounts whose worldview will never shift and who exist primarily to generate engagement for Silicon Valley advertising algorithms. Instead, vote in local elections that actually affect your daily life and the people around you in your community. Maybe volunteer for organizations doing, you know, concrete work in your community. Show up at a town council meeting even when it's boring as hell. Speak up when you witness injustice in spaces where your voice might actually matter. Support independent journalism that practices actual reporting rather than the typical opinion laundering we see now. Look, I know these actions probably aren't glamorous enough to generate viral content, but they're effective at rebuilding social fabric one conversation at a time. Think of it as repairing a sweater that your cat keeps systematically destroying. Yeah, it's tedious, repetitive work that nobody is going to praise you for, but it's absolutely necessary if you want to stay warm. Okay. Third, deliberately build resilient, reality-based communities with people capable of thinking, discussing, disagreeing, and remaining grounded in observable facts rather than partisan fantasy. Remember Carlin's insight? He said you can see the universe in a single person's eyes. You know, which means you don't always need the crowd. You just need a few individuals willing to reflect reality back to you without distortion. Book clubs that read challenging material, philosophy discussion groups that engage with difficult questions, workshops that teach practical skills, even honest conversations with strangers at coffee shops who seem actually capable of nuanced thinking. Real human connection, you know, it serves as both education and inoculation against the hollow comfort of ideological certainty and manufactured tribal belonging. All right. Fourth, reclaim deliberate zones of personal agency in a system designed to harvest your attention and manipulate your behavior. So, curate your information diet as carefully as you would curate your food intake if you were trying to avoid diabetes. Limit your social media consumption to specific times and purposes rather than treating it as just ambient background radiation. Choose your conversations and commitments with intention rather than reactivity. So, you know, it's important to respond rather than react. You can't control the politicians, the algorithms, or the next, you know, manufactured outrage designed to keep you emotionally dysregulated and politically impotent. But I think you can control what you expose your consciousness to, how much mental energy you waste spinning in other people's carefully designed chaos, and whether you respond to provocations with wisdom or just reflexive tribalism. And okay, finally, remember the stakes without becoming paralyzed by their enormity. You know, learned helplessness is democracy's cancer. But despair is authoritarianism's most effective weapon. Resist the psychological temptation to retreat entirely from civic life. I know it's difficult, because that withdrawal, you know, again, it's not wisdom. It's surrender disguised as self-care. Try to continue engaging with the world where your engagement can make some measurable difference. And this is the way you go about it without getting overwhelmed. And just try to stay intellectually awake, emotionally grounded, politically active at the scale where your actions can matter. You know, make your solitude productive and your community authentic. Use both as armor against manipulation. Practice space for clear thinking and, laboratory for experimenting with, sustainable ways of living as a conscious person in unconscious times. Because look, here's the darkly comic truth that authoritarians don't want you to realize. Their systems are powerful, but not omnipotent. Sophisticated, but not impervious to disruption. They win most easily when citizens become passive consumers of information rather than active participants in democracy, when people retreat into private bubbles rather than engaging in public life. And they win when individuals convince themselves they're just powerless rather than recognizing their agency. You know, but even a single person committed to thinking clearly, acting deliberately, and connecting authentically can create a ripple that interference patterns can't predict or control. Now, all that being said, you know, maybe that's not enough to save democracy through heroic, you know, individual effort. But I think it's certainly enough to keep it from collapsing completely while you figure out how to survive with your critical faculties intact and your moral compass still functioning. And let's not forget your sense of absurd humor providing perspective on the whole, this whole tragicomic mess we've created for ourselves. All right. If you made it this far, you are a champion. That's all I got today. Thanks for watching.